Conversations with Friends is a new series.
A series within a series.
Creative conversations between writer friends.
We were blown away by the calibre of the pitches we received from established, mid-career, debut and emerging writers.
From those writing poetry, fiction, non-fiction, plays, newsletters and PhDs.
Conversations to get you through these strange COVID days and beyond.
Sit back, stay home and enjoy. This episode of Conversations with Friends is with Sally Piper and Shady Cosgrove. Shady Cosgrove is the author of What the Ground Can't Hold and She Played Elvis, which was shortlisted for the Australian Vogel Award. She received the 2020 Eleanor Dark Fellowship at Varuna, and her short works have appeared in Best Australian Stories, Overland, Southerly, The Sydney Morning Herald, The Melbourne Age, and various Spineless Wonders publications. She's an associate professor in creative writing at the University of Wollongong, Australia, with teaching interests in prose and editing.
Sally Piper is the author of The Geography of Friendship, which was shortlisted for the 2019 Australian Book Industry Awards, and Grace's Table, shortlisted for the 2011 Queensland Literary Awards. She holds a Master of Arts in Creative Writing from QUT. Sally's short fiction and non-fiction has appeared in various publications in Australia and in the UK. Sally's an active member of the Queensland writing community. In fact, Chrissy Neen, she says she's part of the Brisbane Literary Mafia, where she presents workshops and seminars, leads in conversations and mentors other writers. Sally and Shady, I loved this conversation because it all started at Varuna.
I know.
Oh my gosh. And this was particularly special for me, and I will admit, what do you have to say when you're like, I know this person? I met Sally at Varuna, and those conversations where Sally and Shady are talking about like being in the kitchen and how intense it is and sitting around the fire having wine, I was just right there listening to Sally's voice and going, I was a baby writer at Varuna, and Sally was just the most amazing, warm mentor, and I have remembered it. It was such a significant relationship formed there for me, and I just, Varuna, the magic.
There's something so horror movie too about the idea of being at Varuna when a pandemic, because it's such a bubble, and it's just feel so removed from the real world.
When did you go, and who did you have you stayed in touch with people that you met at Varuna?
I haven't really, actually. I think I got 2 weeks. It was not long after Tilly was born, because I remember it was like that was a really key separation. And if my mother guilt was not bad enough, we'd stayed in Sydney for the night, and then Carney got up really early in the morning to drive back to Melbourne with Tilly. And so they left at sort of 5 and I swanned around in bed and all the rest of it. And they called at 8:30, Carney hugely distressed from the side of the road. He'd had cruise control on in the car, and it had gotten stuck and brake, and the car was just, it was awful. I only found out about it later. Yeah, so the car just kept getting faster and faster, but not stopping. And so the brakes just completely, awful. And he ended up having to put the handbrake on, and apparently there was smoke billowing from, really bad as I was toddling.
Oh, my goodness. So off you go then. Don't worry about us. We'll be fine. Mate.
Yeah, really frightening. We still have that car. We've never used it.
And then you were in the room with the ghost. Were you not?
I was not in the room with the ghost. No, thank God. But there's certain rooms in Varuna I absolutely would, even not knowing or, you know, having not heard about the ghost, there's a couple of rooms that, like that maid's one down the, where you're off the kitchen.
Yeah, yeah.
Like a pretty creepy.
Yeah, I don't know about that room.
I feel like that was a form of pantry or something.
Yeah, maybe. The loveliest thing that happened to me is that, so the first time I went, I was with Sally, and then the next time that I went, Sally left the week before me and I occupied the room that she had just left, and it was so gorgeous. I think it was that way, or did I? Maybe she came after me. Anyway, there was a connection there as well, and it was just completely, completely delightful. And I love that you can listen to Sally and Shady talking, having this intense kind of conversation about process where they really get into the nitty-gritty of how they write. Mm-hmm. And they've only met each other this year, like at Varuna, but that's the kind of intensity that it
works out in people. Pretty special that I found that point of view. There's a point of view discussion, listeners, that I found very pertinent, talking about moving from four points of view to two points of view, or two points of view to three points of view. They're time consuming changes to make, but ultimately, for the manuscript.
Have you just done a little?
Removed a point of view and put them back in. Just a fairly time consuming undertaking.
Well, you clearly needed to do it just to, you know, prove that
test
you could.
Test the waters, exactly.
That was lovely too. That kind of, you know, everyone talks about the Varuna magic. And when they talk about that, they were going there, you know, Shady had to lose characters and Sally had to gain a character. And you could just feel like these weird scepter kind of characters wandering around in Varuna waiting
exactly.
to turn up in someone's manuscript. I thought that was so nice. And that... Sally talks about interviewing characters, how she interviews their characters. And as I was listening to it, I was like, oh, my God, I do that. And I didn't do it for Skylarking, but I did it for this new book. And maybe I got the idea from Sally, because I remember Sally talking about it at Varuna. But you know how at the time I wasn't a writer yet. Like, I didn't understand the whole world of it. And I remember Sally telling me all these things and teaching me things and also telling me lots, which was so helpful about what it was like when your first book came out. And I think only now, you know how sometimes your brain is only just ready to take on information?
Yeah.
That's kind of how that relationship has gone a bit. We will leave you with Sally Piper and Shady Cosgrove as Sally kicks off the conversation.
And I'm the author of two novels, The Geography of Friendship, which was published by the University of Queensland Press in 2019. And my debut novel was Grace's Table, and it was published by University of Queensland Press in 2014.
And I'm Shady Cosgrove. I wrote She Played Elvis, which was published in 2009, and What the Ground Can't Hold, which was published in 2013, and I teach creative writing at the University of Wollongong.
So, Shady, we came to meet each other only very recently. We were at Varuna together in the very last week before lockdown of the whole country, pretty much, and it was a really unusual week there. So you'd been there for, that was your third week there, and it was I was just there for the 1 week. Do you want to talk a bit about what the difference from your first week at Varuna was like compared to your third week there?
Absolutely. So there's a few things that were at play. One was the state of the world and kind of the advancing of Corona. And it was, the bizarre thing was being at Varuna where nothing seemed to change. And then suddenly it was like the very details of life began to change. But it was almost imperceptible until towards the end. It was radically different from the beginning. Yet there was still this sense of, you know, commitment to writing, you know, being time for brainstorming, time for working. And it was interesting. So you have the Corona situation, but then there's also the situation of the work itself. So when you're in the first week of working on a project, as opposed to the third week, and, you know, you kind of are aware of your time is coming to an end, and there's this kind of ferocity as you're working through, that was also kind of being mimicked by the intensity coming in from the outside world. The first week, I don't know, for folks who haven't been to Varuna, it's a stunning, you know, five writers with rooms and workshops. And one of the highlights of the time is that there's a cook, Sheila, who cooks these incredible meals, and you look forward to them, and there's kind of these banquet styles and, you know, writerly conversation about what, you know, what people's projects are and where they're at. And I just had a lovely, lovely time in that kind of first week. And then by the final week, you know, and there was no, you know, people hugged when they met each other, and there was no sense of kind of social distancing. It was something I was vaguely aware of on the train coming up to Katoomba. But then it was interesting by the final week, you know, it felt radical, in fact, radical and exciting when, like, Sally and I had a secret hug, like, we're like, oh, goodbye. And then, but also, like, the food, Sheila wasn't cooking in the house anymore, so she was bringing food and leaving it, and we were heating it up. And then we were washing dishes, but only a certain number of people could be in the kitchen at a time. And my hands were kind of chapped and, you know, chapped from the, you know, with a constant hand washing, things like that.
And we weren't allowed to congregate in the kitchen, and that is sort of one of the things that Varuna is renowned for, is that you'd come down for your coffee or your mint sliced biscuit, and there was always someone, nearly always someone in the kitchen that you could have some sort of exchange with, it because it's quite a pressure cooker system there, where as a writer you go in there knowing you've got this week, or in your case you had 3 weeks, and it's very intense, and then you just need a little release out of that pressure cooker moment. And then I know for me, when I was there, I was only there for the week, but so I had this pressure of the writing, and then this pressure of the uncertainty of how I was even going to get home, because they were starting to talk about closing borders. And I was thinking, oh my God, am I going to have to get my husband to come and pick me up from Brisbane down to Sydney? And yeah, so it was just the weirdest of times, wasn't it? I think it was difficult for the staff as well, with knowing what the next week was going to be. We had another girl was there with us on a 2-week fellowship, and hers was cut short because of Varuna having to close. So a very unusual Varuna experience. But you were there on the Eleanor Dark Fellowship, the inaugural, I believe, the inaugural Eleanor Dark Fellowship. I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about that, and, you know, how you used the time, what it's meant for your career. Just anything you've got to say about that, because that's a fantastic opportunity.
Oh, Sally, you're so kind. Look, it was an incredible, incredible opportunity. But one thing I would like to flag for folks is I have been, you know, I've had many dear writer friends have spent time at Varuna and have won fellowships and have won, you know, residencies. And I have tried for years and years, right? And I've never, you know, I was never successful. And then it came together. And so one of the things I would like to just say is for folks out there who are like, oh, I've tried, there's different judges, things shift, things change, your project moves along from year to year. Keep applying, because I never would have thought that I would be winning the Eleanor Dark. Like, I, that was beyond my realm of. In fact, when the email came in, I was like, oh, what's this? And then to have that kind of news that I would get 3 weeks to be, you know, working on this project was stunning. In terms of my career, in terms of my writing practice, what it did is it took me out of my day-to-day life so that I was able to focus entirely on this manuscript. And I had an issue of voice that I needed. I needed to kind of, I was dropping from 4 points of view to 2, and I was moving from third person to first. And so one of the things, obviously, as soon as you're working in first person, is you have to be, the voices have to be distinct, and they have to draw us into character. And so by having that time, I was able to make that transition with the manuscript. And it, but it needed that kind of intense focus. Like, would that character use that word, you know, without the distractions of the everyday? So in terms of that, I've finished the draft. I got I had maybe 3 chapters left after the 3 weeks that I needed to work on. And so I finished that and then have sent it off. So in terms of my career, hopefully it was a stunning rewrite, and my agent is super excited about it. But, you know, we'll wait to see, and we'll cross that bridge when we get there.
And I think what you said about continuing to apply for things, I think that as writers, that applies to every single activity, doesn't it? You know, that the perseverance, you cannot do this job unless you have a great sense of perseverance to turn up every day and apply for all these things, whether it be competitions, whether it be fellowships, whether it be grants, anything. It's just there's only so many spots available, and it's not always our moment for when those spots are being judged. But as you said, the next time it well could be. So, and it was interesting because on our first night at Varuna, you sit in the lounge room and have an introduction. You have a glass of wine, which is always very nice. And I think where you and I sort of made eye contact when we both had to talk about what it was we were there to do. So you were there, as you've just said, to lose two characters, and I was there to gain one character. And we both talked a lot about this activity that we had to do, this particular purpose that we were there for, and we'd each been advised that we should do that, those changes to our characters by our editors. And I said, the first thing I might talk about is I can't imagine losing two characters. I think that must have been a huge undertaking. But for me to gain one, and when my editor, Aviva Tuffield, made this suggestion to me, I was just with relief, actually, because you get stuck in a project, as we probably all know. And I've got three characters in my current third novel now that I'm working on. Two of them were already there, and there was just something not moving with this novel. I got to the classic 30,000 word mark, 40,000 word mark, and I often find that the story gets quite sluggish about then. And that's when Aviva had a look at the work for me, and it was her recommendation that I build a third character into it. And it was, she didn't say who, I just had to work that out myself. So, and there was a secondary character in there, which I did decide was the one that I needed to build into a bigger feature into the story. And I think one of the reasons the other two weren't working is they were each having very similar experiences within the story, and I needed a third character who was coming at it with a completely different perspective. And so that's how I went with this character, and that is, it was only her that I worked on while I was at Varuna. And I think she's really brought a whole different dimension to the story. But how with your story, you had to lose two characters from a four point of view story.
Well, I lost two points of view. The characters were still there, but we didn't have access to what they're thinking in such kind of a clear and obvious way. So what it meant is that I had to be a lot more strategic about the dialogue that was happening between the characters to give hints, and the body language. And I had to use plot points to kind of go, oh, maybe this point of view that we're getting isn't entirely reliable, right? So that it then set up, oh, what's he thinking there? And I had a similar situation as you, where my agent was like, hey, you know, I think you should just try having only two points of view, or restructuring the point of view. Like, do you keep the four but then set them in blocks, as opposed to, you know, interchanging, you know, short chapters that move between and circle back. And so she wasn't attached to which ones I lost. But what was interesting for me is I realized I wanted to set up the story between two characters, but the thing that interested me the most was the friendship between the two women. And so if I lost either of the women's points of view, we weren't going to be able to have that connection between, like, one would then be given more priority over the other. And the point for me was to kind of deconstruct some of the power stuff that was going on there. And so by giving them both equal voice, it then made sure that the structure of the project was actually supporting the themes that I wanted to do. So not only does the book now move much quicker, like, it's really affected the pacing, it's also affected the depth, because instead of going deep into four points of view, or not as deep as maybe it needed to be, it has more space. So even though the novel's shorter now, and not substantially shorter, only 5,000 or 6,000 words shorter, but it means that we have more scope for getting that kind of in-depth work with the characters. And because there's because I did this work on voice, they're also more distinct. So that's really helped things. But it at first, I have to say, I was just like, you know, I'm going to try this. I don't think it could work, but I'm going to try it. And then as soon as I started, I was like, oh my God, this is going to be so much better. But there was that thing of like, it's always okay to try it. And it's always okay to remind yourself that you don't have to go with the latest exploration. And yet I find I never go back. But sometimes I have to tell myself, it's okay if I don't take it. You know, it's okay to experiment and try this, and it doesn't have to work. And then frequently it's like in that relinquishing, it does begin to work.
Because you, I read on your website actually, because you're an academic teacher teaching at Wollongong Uni, and you said your students teach you to fail better, which I thought was such a fantastic way of looking at it, isn't it? It makes you a better writer by looking at your failures and then improving on those.
Well, and that's what I'm interested. Like, I'm interested in, well, where isn't the manuscript working? Like, where are you losing track? Where are you bored? Where, you know, because without that knowledge, you don't know what to fix. And, you know, I do have to say it's sometimes hard. Like, it's easy to preach failing better. And then when you're like there and you get the feedback and you're like, oh, I thought I was close and I'm nowhere near. It's not easy. But I mean, one of the things that I loved talking about with you when we were at Varuna was process. And one of the things that was such a treat at Varuna was, you know, getting to read your novel and thinking about the ways that you were using point of view and then being able to have those conversations with it. So can you talk a little bit just about your experiences with point of view, kind of both past and present?
Yeah, so voice is one of those elusive things, isn't it? You know when you've got it and you know when you haven't got it, but you don't always know the path to which you took to get there. And I give it a lot of thought, especially having to reintroduce a third character. And it's about that having that third character did increase the scope of the novel, which is what you've just remarked upon, which is, you know, that's so worth thinking about, is any advice to any writer. If it seems to be slowing down or there's not enough happening, have a think about whether you need to introduce somebody else. And that certainly was the case with mine. But it's creating voice for me is about creating this standalone entity so that, and I was thinking about it, so there's sort of three or four things that for me create voice. So it's authenticity of your character, that the actions that they perform are driven by themselves and not me. So I know I do quite a bit of mentoring with people, and sometimes what I see missing with characterization and with the point, the voice of the character, is that I can see where the authors needed them to do something, but not actually built it into the nature of the character so that they need to do that thing. So I think action and motivations for those actions are really important. But when I know I've got voice is when the dialogue starts driving itself. If I've got that character and I've really got them pictured in my head, they start writing their own dialogue. And if I'm in an exchange of conversation between two characters, I barely have to think about what they say in response to the other character. And when I reach that point, that's probably one of the most satisfying points in character development, because I feel then, yes, that character is a standalone entity and they have their own voice. And from that, usually their actions are driven by themselves, not by my need to make them do something to move the story along. So I guess they're the things that I look at when I think about voices: authenticity, actions and motivations, and the dialogue.
Yep.
Yeah.
It was interesting for me because when voice frequently isn't there in my early drafts.
No, so not at all.
Work at. It's not like I hear the story and I write it down and it's there. So it'll come back where it's like, okay, well, you have enough things happening. You have the characters, they're different enough, it follows clear arcs. But there's something about the project that's not sucking the reader in the same way or in the way that I'd like. And so it's been interesting that as soon as I figure out the voices and as soon as voice clicks into place, my project goes from feeling like, you know, 85,000 words that are coherent and pieced together, but just 85,000 words, you know, that follow on, to a novel. Like there's something about voice that just clicks it into gear where it's like, oh, I could read this as a book. And it's interesting for me that that's not there. You know, even you might have the requisite number of words, but that doesn't mean it has that feeling of a novel. And so that's been something interesting for me to think about. I had character down. I knew who they were, but it was only when I really started thinking about, well, what's their lexicon? What are the words that they use? Do they think in metaphors? One character thinks in metaphors. One is just straight up and down. Paragraph length. It was when I went, oh, paragraphs. Like how long do their thoughts go? How long does the internal monologue go? Is it choppy? Is it smooth? You know, and language, what kind of, you know, we're back to lexicon, but also just how do the sentences flow from one another? You know, are there short, choppy sentences, or, you know, is there a bit more length to them? And so that was interesting as well. Even just things, you know, in terms of, you know, in earlier drafts, they sounded very similar, right? Kind of makes sense because it was coming from a kind of a distanced third person, but it needed that differentiation as soon as I pulled it into first. But that's the thing that made it feel more coherent.
It's interesting because I think with how I develop the character and what you're saying I can relate to is you start off, and I'm sure most writers can relate to this, they don't know the people who are going to occupy their novels often. There's the people who plan, and obviously they do, but I'm not a planner or a plotter. I tend to write really organically. And for me, when I get started, I call it, I have to do a job interview for my characters. So it's like they're sitting across from me at a desk and I'm interviewing them for a job. And the way I do that is I write by scenes. So I don't start a linear narrative when I start a novel. I just start with a scene that may or may not end up in the book. And so I'll just present this character with either another character to interact with, or a point of conflict, or some kind of situation, and I will start writing a scene that answers that. And usually at the bottom, before, just below where I write the text, is I write the word purpose and I have a question mark. So as I write, I follow that word down the page, and the purpose is, what is the purpose of this scene? And so underneath that word purpose, I'll have a few bullet points. Is, am I looking to build character? Am I looking to build conflict? Am I building place, setting where this person is to live or to exist? And so anything I write follows this word purpose down the page. And often in those early drafts, there is no purpose. And it's actually me as the author talking to myself. And it's about me giving that character backstory that may not necessarily even end up on the page within the novel, but it'll certainly be there within the whole form of that character to help build them to this three-dimensional person that they need to become, this standalone entity. So that's my process. So I write scene by scene, and I forget who it was talked about. I think it was Karen Foxley. She talked about, because I think she also writes in this scene process, and I know other people do as well. And so it's like having a piece of mirror, a piece of broken fragment of mirror. And what you're doing with all these scenes, which are all these different broken fragments of mirror, is eventually you're putting them together so that you have a whole mirror looking at you, which is the whole story, which is usually reflecting yourself. And I guess that's where I start from with a novel, is about questions, and about, I have questions that I want to answer, and that those questions, as they are with any research study, whether it be higher education or any questions about anything in your life is you start off with these fragments of questions that you want to answer. And then by the end of that story, hopefully you have a mirror that reflects what it is that you think is the answer to that, those questions along the way.
It's fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah, it's all just because you talked about, and I've adopted this since I've got back, you talk about this 52-minute cycle you do, which I've since heard is called the Pomodoro technique. And you told me about that when we were at Varuna together, because I talk about, I compared it to my cat circling a cushion.
Yes.
So I'm like this cat that's constantly walking, trying to find itself a comfortable spot on a cushion before it'll arrive. And I can spend a whole day circling that cushion. But you sit down and you set your timer for 52 minutes and you write for 52 minutes. I wonder if you could just talk a bit about that, because I was fascinated by that. And I have used it since I got back from Varuna, by the way, to great effect.
Absolutely. Well, and interestingly, like I was fascinated when you were talking about process, because you're talking about you kind of just wading in and seeing where the characters take you. And I'm much more structured. Like I'll have a novel outline before I sit down and work it. And I will workshop my novel outline. So with writer friends, with my agent, like which, you know, like I sent my agent three outlines, like which ones, you know, could I go with? And, you know, she's like, oh, you can go these two are great. This one, it's too similar to something that's come out. Let that go. And then what's interesting is some of my projects have really detailed outlines. And then this one had a less detailed outline, but I had a sense of what was driving it. And I think there's something important about that, you know, the fluidity of, and even though it had a very, talking over myself here, but even though it had an outline, it ended up going someplace completely different in the end. Like I ended up changing the last third of the book. But I find the outline just gives me something to kind of hold on to as I'm writing through. And so, but I also find it's important to workshop even just the outlines. Like, well, what bits are interesting? What's not interesting? And then in terms of getting the outline down, in terms of getting the words onto the page, I work in 52-minute increments, and I credit Caroline Graham. She's an academic in writing and journalism at Bond University, and she and I have done a number of resident writing retreats and residencies together where we've we'll set the 52 minutes and we will sit there and there's something. And then my sister is also a writer. So she and I have been doing this. And I have a colleague, Christine Howe, where there's something, the 52 minutes, you know, it's not an hour. So like psychologically, I can get my head around it. Frequently, if it's less, if it's like 30 minutes, I'm just getting into a good flow. So I need a bit more time. And Caroline, I think the 52, she just picked randomly. When I take a break, it is longer than the 8 minutes that would take me to an hour, just to be absolutely clear. But I'm also a fan of carrots and of figuring out, like, what are the carrots that are going to get me through the 52 minutes? So frequently it's, a Skype call with my sister, or there'll be a cup of tea waiting for me, but like a special, fancy, exciting tea, you know, that I, you know, am looking forward to. And so it's this kind of, you know, I have to be careful because for a little while it was chocolate and then it was like kind of oh, God, you know, I have to maybe pull back on that one a little bit. I was getting a little too excited there. But I find that structure helps me because it takes the focus off how many words or how many pages. And really what it is it's the time that I need to spend on the manuscript. And I talk about this with my students about, you know, thinking about what are your metaphors of writing, you know, and it used to be that writing felt like this kind of Promethean effort, you know, where it's like, you're tied to a rock and this raven comes and eats your liver and then the gods like are punishing you and you're just kind of trapped going through this process over and over and over again.
Isn't that how we meet you?
And now it's much more about, there's a yogic term called abhyasa, which is basically you set the goal, but then you put the goal aside and you just do the daily work. And so I just work on doing the daily work. Like, what's in front of me? How can I work on this project? Yes, I want to complete it. Yes, I want to send it off to Tori. But that will only happen if I just sit in the moment doing the work that's straight in front of me. So that, I mean, that's the process that I've found. I think one thing, Margaret Atwood came to Wollongong, you know, years and years and decades ago, in fact, and talked about process. And she said, you know, a lot of people will tell you fancy, frightening, you know, oh, you have to get up at 5 a.m. and you must write for 3 hours and 26 minutes. And then you need to run around the house and circle a black cat or, you know, like, well, you have these kind of rituals. And I think it's just important to just signpost to people, different things will work for you, right? Like different writers work in different ways. All you have to do is figure out what is it that gets the words on the page for you, you know? And if that's, you know, a regular, you know, writing between 4 and 5 a.m., good on you. But also if it's, you know, I'm a mother of a son, you know, he's a school age, you know, working through that kind of stuff. And especially in coronavirus times, you know, it's like our daily schedules have been a bit up in the air. And it's really just about writing when you can for me, you know, and when can I grab a 52 minute, you know, and hide myself in my office. So I think there's something that, you know, I think a lot of people are looking for the perfect, you know, the perfect system or the perfect pattern or the perfect, you know, technique.
There is one, you know, because your cat circling a cushion, that's worked for you, you know? Trouble is it doesn't always work. And I did try your 52-minute cycle technique when I got home from Varuna. And, you know, it does work. And as you said to me, it gets the work done. And yeah, that's what it does. And, you know, that 52 minutes just flies. And it's, I don't know whether it was because I knew I had a timer on me. I usually work on a word count. I try and get a 500-word word count in a day if I'm sitting down at the desk. But, no, I've used that technique quite a bit since I've got home and really enjoyed it. So thank you.
Wow. Tell Caroline. I'm like, we have another convert.
You do, definitely. And it goes so quickly. That's the bit that I couldn't believe. And now we're getting nearer to the end of our time, and one of the things I really wanted to talk about is that we all talk about writers, always talk about their writing process, but we never really talk about what kind of readers we are. And reading is our end game. That's why we're here. We're to provide something for people to read. But I think as writers, we get very focused on how we do that. And sometimes it's just nice to stop and pause and think about who we are as readers. So what sort of a reader are you, Shady?
Well, it's funny because on one level, you know, my students are like, oh, you've destroyed reading for me. Like I can't handle adverbs anymore. You know, what is it? But I find that I try to be the kind of reader that I hope would pick up my book, so that there's a generosity going into the reading process, but it's a thoughtful, critically engaged generosity. So I find that frequently, you know, sometimes I'll get caught up on like, well, how was that sentence structured? But then when you fall into a story, and even though I've spent so much time thinking about words and sentences and placement and emphasis and plot, character, setting, narrative arc, when I can still drop in and just follow the story and I'm invested in the characters, there's nothing that's lovelier, you know? Like I love writing, but like reading, when you're dropped in and you're taken into another world, you know, without all of the work of drafting and redrafting and redrafting, it's just an exquisite, exquisite feeling. I've been reading Olive Again by Elizabeth Strout right now, and I'm utterly, utterly compelled by these characters.
Yeah. It's interesting. I did a course with a UK writer called Jay Griffith, and she spoke about, as writers, we should be humble servants and we should write on bended knee. And I thought that was just one of the most beautiful quotes I've ever heard about writing. And I think for me, reading a book where I can witness that as a reader, that the writer of that story has been a humble servant to that story, is what absolutely sings to me. But it's interesting, because I have research reading, as we all do, as you do, I'm sure, and my research reading is like a treasure hunt. So you read one book and then it cites another book and say, then you go and read that book and then that book cites someone else. And I can spend years in that kind of reading on this treasure hunt pursuit of the next research book. But often at the detriment of the latest books that are coming out. So then I reach a point where I can pull out of the research reading and then I have a binge on all the latest releases, which I've just come through, which has been fantastic. But I think I'm probably a slow reader. I'm not fast at all. And I think that's because I'm also looking for that humble servant of the writer and so looking at technique a lot. I'm probably most enthralled and captivated by stories that are character driven. I'm not so caught up on a plot, but I have to have characters that I just want to spend all the time of that book with together. And I guess for me, it's when I finish a story, I like to feel that I finish that story with the character taking a breath in, not breathing out. I want them to take that breath in on an inhalation, and then that's when the story finishes, because you know there is a breath out, there is something that comes next. So, yeah, that's the sort of reader I am. I just wish I was a quicker reader, because then I could read all those books that are coming out, all those wonderful books that are coming out all the time, and just get through them more quickly. But to be slow as a reader doesn't, apart from missing out on some books that I wish I could read, I think being a slow reader works well for me. It works well for me, yeah.
Well, it's interesting because when I'm reading, I'll be kind of caught up and I'll be absorbed, and then I'll go, okay, well, what was it that was catching me up? And I go back and I reread and I'm like, oh, like, you know, with, you know, Olive again, it's the way the observations of life, it's like the details, but it's the way that she phrases them, but it's not just the words, it's the observation that's gone into that. Or it's the way the stories interlock and give us different perspectives. And so frequently it's from what I'm reading that I think, oh, that's something that I want to explore in my next book. So like She Played Elvis, I was inspired. I mean, you wouldn't know now because it's completely changed, but I was inspired by Alessandro Baricco's Silk and the way that he structures chapters very, very short. And that ended up, so the early drafts of She Played Elvis were very, very short. Like page and a half maximum chapters, heaps of them. And then in that context, because I didn't have the same poetic element happening that Baricco did, it just didn't work, you know. So I ended up segging them together and it became quite a different narrative. And nobody reading it now would have any connection with, you know, that early, the early draft, you know, that was kind of playing with form in that way. But it was one of those things where I was like, oh, and then it was like, okay, so it's not just the choice of how to structure the chapters, it's also the way the poetic was, you know, the use of language, I would argue setting as well. And so what I find is the reading helps me think through what it is that I'm writing and what it is I want to be writing. Because I think for me, I write because I want to be in conversation with the books that inspire and ignite me, you know, like that's what I want to be doing. I want to be in conversation. And the way to do that is by kind of going, oh, well, this works here and this works here. What if I try to interweaving this? And then it frequently, you know, the project will become a beast of its own. It'll go somewhere else entirely. And those original facets aren't there. But I like to think that it's like that even though they've been erased or they've been changed, that those early echoes still reverberate in the text, you know, so that the texts that I'm creating is in conversation with the texts that have created me as a reader and writer.
And I think that's a perfect spot to finish a conversation with friends on. I think you've summed it up. Your writer is in conversation with every reader that comes to the book, and that's what greater joy could we have?
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you, Sally. It's just been absolutely lovely talking with you. And thank you for suggesting this.
Yeah, it was fantastic chatting to you. And I'd also like to thank Kate and Catherine from First Time Podcast for having us on to chat together, to have this opportunity to continue our Varuna conversation. And I'd also like to thank people for tuning in to listen.
Absolutely. Thank you.
You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. The First Time Podcast is produced by Phoebe 80 and supported by Writers Victoria, the ACT Writers Centre, and our wonderful patrons.
This series is supported by the City of Melbourne through a COVID-19 arts grant.